cried in a flood of embarrassment. These are missionaries. My girls, good girls, the father shouted reassuringly, shoving his handsome women aboard as he had done so often in the past. Those girls swimming no good, plenty sick. Heavenly Father, Abner whispered to Brother Whipple, are they his own daughters? At this point, two of the girls saw the old whaler who had saved the Thetis off the four evangelists, and apparently they remembered him kindly, for they ran across the deck, calling him by name, and threw their arms about him. But he, seeing Jerusha Hale's dismay, tried to brush them away, as a man keeps flies from his face when he's eating. Go back, go back, Keoki pleaded in Hawaiian. And gradually the four laughing daughters, and their beautiful naked mother, began to realize that on this ship, unlike all others, they were not wanted. And in some confusion they climbed back into the canoe, which their family had acquired by providing such services to passing ships. Sadly, the man of the house, his day's profits gone, paddled his employees back to Lahaina, and whenever he came to groups of girls swimming to the Thetis, he called in bewilderment, "Turn back! No girls are wanted!" And the convoy of island beauties sadly returned to the shore and dressed. Aboard the Thetis, Abner Hale, who had never before seen a naked woman, said dazedly to his brothers, "There's going to be a lot of work to do in Lahaina." Now from the shore came out two other Hawaiians of sharply different character. Abner first saw them when a large canoe with vassals standing at stern and prow bearing yellow-feathered staffs became the center of an extraordinary commotion. Islanders moved about in agitation, as among them appeared two of the most gigantic human beings Abner had so far seen. "That's my father," Keoki Kanakoa shouted to the missionaries. And by choice, he came to stand with the Hales, repeating to Abner, "The tall man is my father, guardian of the king's estates." "I thought he was king of Maui," Abner remarked with disappointment. "I never said so," Keoki replied. "The people in Boston did. They thought it impressed the Americans." "Who is the woman?" Jerusha inquired. "My mother. She's the highest chief in the islands. When my father wants to ask her a question of state, he has to crawl into the room on his hands and knees. So do I." Along the railing, the missionaries studied the enormous woman, who half climbed, half relaxed as her subjects heaved her fantastic bulk into the canoe. Keoki's mother was 6 feet 4 inches tall, stately, long-haired, noble in every aspect, and weighed 320 pounds. Her massive forearms were larger than the bodies of many men, while her gigantic middle, swathed in many layers of richly patterned tapa, seemed more like the trunk of some forest titan than of a human being. By her bulk alone, it could be seen that she was a chief. But her most conspicuous features were her two splendid breasts, which hung in massive brown grandeur above the soft red and yellow tapa. The missionary men stared in wonder. The women gazed in awe. "We call her the Ali'i Nui," Keoki whispered reverently. "It is from her that our manna flows." Abner looked at his young Christian friend in amazement, as if some foul error had corrupted him. "It is from God, and not from an Ali'i Nui, that your spiritual consecration flows," he corrected. The young Hawaiian blushed, and with attractive candor explained, "When you have lived a long time with one idea, you sometimes express better ideas in the same careless way." Again Abner frowned, as if his labors with Keoki were being proved futile. "God isn't what you call a better idea, Keoki," he said firmly. "God is a superlative fact. He stands alone and brooks no comparisons. You don't worship God merely because he represents a better idea." Abner spoke contemptuously, but Keoki, with tears of considerable joy in his eyes, did not recognize that fact and accepted the words in love. I am sorry, Brother Hale, he said contritely. I used the word thoughtlessly. I think it would be better, Keoki, Abner reflected, if from now on you referred to me in the old way, Reverend Hale. Your people might not understand the title brother. Jerusha interrupted and asked, Didn't we agree that we were to call one another brother and sister? That was among ourselves, Mrs. Hale, Abner explained patiently. Isn't Keoki one of ourselves? Jerusha pressed. I think the term ourselves refers principally to ordained ministers and their wives, Abner judged. When you have been ordained, Keoki, it'll be Brother Abner, Jerusha assured the young Hawaiian. But even though you are not yet ordained, Keoki, I am your sister, Jerusha. And she stood beside him and said, Your father and mother are handsome people. With great dignity, and with yellow feathers on the staffs fluttering in the wind, the long canoe approached the Thetis. And for the first time, the Hales saw the full majesty of Keoki's father. Not so large in bulk as the Ele'inui, he was nevertheless taller, 6'7", and of striking presence. His hair was a mixture of black and gray. His brown face was cut by deep lines of thought, and his expressive eyes shone out from beneath heavy brows. He was dressed in a cape of yellow feathers and a skirt of red tappa, but his most conspicuous ornament was a feathered helmet, close-fitting to the head, but with a narrow crest of feathers that started at the nape of the neck, sweeping over the back of the head and reaching well in front of the forehead. By some mysterious trick of either history or the human mind, Kalolo, guardian of the king's estates, wore exactly the same kind of helmet as had Achilles, Ajax, and Agamemnon. But because his people had never discovered metals, his was of feathers, whereas theirs had been of iron. Seeing his tall son on the deck of the Thetis, Giant Kalolo deftly grabbed a rope as it was lowered to him, and with swift movements sprang from the canoe onto a footing along the starboard side of the Thetis, and then adroitly onto the deck. Abner gasped. He must weigh nearly 300 pounds, he whispered to Jerusha. But she had now joined Keoki in tears, for the affectionate manner in which Giant Kalolo and his long-absent son embraced, rubbed noses, and wept, reminded her of her own parents, and she held her lace handkerchief to her eyes. Finally, Keoki broke away and said, Captain Janders, my father wishes to pay his respects. And the tough New England sea captain came aft to acknowledge the greeting. Kalolo, proud of having learned from earlier ships how properly to greet a Westerner, thrust out his powerful right hand, and as Captain Janders took it, he saw tattooed from wrist to shoulder the awkward purple letters, Tamehameha King. Can your father write in English? Janders asked. Keoki shook his head and spoke rapidly in Hawaiian. When Kalolo replied, the son said, One of the Russians did this for my father, in 1819, when our great king Kamehameha died. Why did he spell it Tamehameha? Janders asked. Our language is just now being written for the first time, Keoki explained. The way you Americans have decided to spell it is neither right nor wrong. My father's name you spell Kalolo. It would be just as right to spell it Teroro. You mean the truth lies somewhere in between? Janders asked. Eagerly, Keoki grasped the captain's hand and pumped it, as if the latter had said something which had suddenly illuminated a difficult problem. Yes, Captain, the young man said happily. In these matters, the truth does lie somewhere in between. The idea was repugnant to Abner, particularly since he had been increasingly worried about Keoki's apparent reversion to paganism as Hawaii neared. There is always only one truth, the young missionary corrected. Keoki willingly assented, explaining, In matters of God, of course there is only one truth, Reverend Hale. But in spelling my father's name, there is no final truth. It lies between Kalolo and Teroro, and is neither. Keoki, Abner said patiently, A committee of missionaries, well-versed in Greek, Hebrew, and Latin, studied in Honolulu for more than a year deciding how to spell Hawaiian names. They didn't act in haste or ignorance, and they decided that your father's name should be spelled Kelolo. Thoughtlessly, Keoke pointed out, they also decided the town should be called Honolulu, but its real name is closer to Honoruru, as you said. Abner flushed and was about to utter some sharp correction, when Captain Janders rescued the moment by admiringly grasping Kelolo's tattooed arm and observing, Tamehameha, a very great king, Ali'i Nui Nui. Kelolo, confused by the earlier argument, smiled broadly and returned the compliment. Patting the railing of the Thetis, he said in Hawaiian, This is a very fine ship. I shall buy this ship for Malama, the Ali'i Nui, and you, Captain Janders, shall be our captain. When this was translated by Keoki, Captain Janders did not laugh, but looked steadily at Kelolo and nodded sagely. Ask him how much sandalwood he can bring me for the ship. I have been saving my sandalwood, Kelolo said cautiously. There is much more in the mountains of Maui. I can get the sandalwood. Tell him that if he can get the sandalwood, I can get the ship. When Kelolo heard the news, he started to shake hands in the American manner, but cautiously Captain Janders held back. Tell him that he does not get the Thetis until I have carried the sandalwood to Canton and brought back a load of Chinese goods, which shall be my property to sell. That is reasonable, Kelolo agreed, and once more he proudly held forth his hand to bind the bargain. This time Captain Janders grasped it, adding prudently, Mr. Collins, draw up an agreement in 3 copies. State that we will sell the Thetis for a full cargo of sandalwood now, plus an equal amount when we return from China. When the terms were translated, Kelolo solemnly agreed, whereupon Mr. Collins whispered, That's a hell of a lot of sandalwood. Replied Janders, This is a hell of a lot of ship. It's a fair deal. While the towering chief was concluding the deal, Abner had an opportunity to study him closely, and his eye was attracted to the symbol of power that Kelolo wore about his brown neck. From a very thick, dark necklace, apparently woven of some tree fiber, dangled a curiously shaped chunk of ivory, about 5 inches long and 1.5 inches wide. But what was remarkable was the manner in which, at the bottom, a lip flared out and up, so that the entire piece resembled an antique adze for shaping trees. What is it? Abner whispered to Keoki. The mark of an ali'i, Keoki replied. What's it made of? A whale's tooth. It must be heavy to wear, Abner suggested. Whereupon Keoki took the missionary's hand and thrust it under the tooth so that Abner could test the surprising weight. In the old days, Keoki laughed, you would be killed for touching an ali'i. Then he added, The weight doesn't bother him, because the necklace of human hair supports it. Is that hair? Abner gasped. And again Keoki passed his friend's hand over the woven necklace, which Keoki explained had been made of some 2,000 separate braids of plaited hair, each braid having been woven from 80 individual pieces of hair. The total length of hair, Abner began. Well, it's impossible. And all from the heads of friends, Keoki said proudly. Before Abner could comment on this barbarism, a considerable commotion occurred at the side of the Thetis, and the missionaries ran to witness an extraordinary performance. From the mainmast, 2 stout ropes had been lowered over the canoe which still held Malama, the Ali'i Nui. The ends of the ropes were fastened to a rugged canvas sling that was customarily slipped under the bellies of horses and cows, hoisting them in this fashion onto the deck of the ship. Today, the canvas sling was being used as a giant cradle into which the men in the canoe gently placed their revered chief crosswise, so that her feet and arms dangled over the edges of the canvas, which ensured her stability, while her enormous chin rested on the hard rope binding which kept the canvas from tearing. "Is she all settled?" Captain Janders asked solicitously. "She's squared away," a sailor shouted. "Don't drop her," Janders warned, "or we'll be massacred." "Gently, gently," the men working the ropes chanted. And slowly the gigantic Ali'i Nui was swung aboard the Thetis. As her big dark eyes, ablaze with childish curiosity, reached the top of the railing, while her chin rested on the edge of the canvas and her body sprawled happily behind, she waved her right hand in a grand gesture of welcome and allowed her handsome features to break into a contented smile. "Aloha! Aloha! Aloha!" she said repeatedly in a low, soft voice, her expressive eyes sweeping the row of black-frocked missionaries in their clawhammer coats. But her warmest greeting was for the skinny yet attractive young women who stood sedately in the rear. It would have taken almost 4 Amanda Whipples to equal the bulk of this giant woman as she lay in the canvas sling. "Aloha! Aloha!" she kept crying in her musical voice as she swung over the women. "For the love of God," Janders shouted, "take it easy now. Gently, gently." As the ropes were eased over the capstans, the canvas sling slowly dropped toward the deck. Instantly, Captain Janders, Kelolo, and Keoki rushed forward to intercept the sling, lest the Ali'i Nui be bruised in landing. But her bulk was so ponderous that in spite of their efforts to hold the sling off the deck, it pressed its way resolutely down, forcing the men to their knees and, finally, to a sprawling position. Undisturbed, the noble woman rolled over on the canvas, found her footing, and rose to majestic height, her bundles of tappa making her seem even larger than she was. Quietly, she passed down the line of missionaries, greeting each with her musical "Aloha, Aloha." But when she came to the storm-tossed women, whose voyage she could imagine and whose underweight she instantly perceived, she could not restrain herself and broke into tears. Gathering little Amanda Whipple to her great bosom, she wept for some moments, then rubbed noses with her as if she were a daughter. Moving to each of the women in turn, she continued her weeping and smothered them in her boundless love. "Aloha, aloha," she repeated. Then, facing the women and ignoring their husbands as she did her own, she spoke softly, and when her son interpreted the words, they said, "My adorable little children, you must think of me always as your mother. Before, the white men have sent us only sailors and shopkeepers and troublemakers, never any women. But now you come, so we know that the intentions of the Americans must at last be good." Malama, the Ali'i Nui, the most sacred, manna-filled human being on Maui, waited grandly while this greeting was being delivered. And when the missionary wives acknowledged it, she moved down the line again, rubbing noses with each of the women and repeating, "You are my daughter." Then, overcome both by the emotion and the exertions of getting aboard the Thetis, Malama, her great moon face sublime in newfound comfort, slowly unfastened the tappas that bound her great bulk. Handing the ends to her servants, she ordered them to walk away from her, while she unwound like a top until she stood completely naked, except for a hair necklace from which dangled a single majestic whale's tooth. Scratching herself in gasping relief, she indicated that she would lie down and chose the canvas sling as a likely place. But when she stretched out on her stomach, the missionaries were appalled to see tattooed along the full length of her left ham the purple letters, "Tamehameha King, died 1819. "Did the Russians do that too?" Captain Janders asked. "They must have," Keoki replied. He asked his mother about the memento, and she twisted her head to study it. Tears came into her eyes, and Keoki explained, She was the 19th wife of Kamehameha the Great. Jerusha gasped, "Why, she was no better than a concubine." "In many ways," Keoki continued, "Malama was the favorite of the king's last years. Of course, since she was the Ali'inui, she was entitled to other husbands as well." "You mean she was married to your father at the same time?" Abner asked suspiciously. "Of course," Keoki explained. "Kamehameha himself consented, because my father was her younger brother, and their marriage was essential." "Throw some water on that woman," Captain Jander shouted. For one of the missionary wives, overcome by Malama's nudity and marital complications, had fainted. Keoki, sensing the reasons, went to his mother and whispered that she ought to cover herself, for Americans hated the sight of the human body. And the great, sprawling woman assented. "Tell them," she said enthusiastically, "that henceforth I shall dress like them." But before Keoki could do this, she quietly asked Captain Janders if he could provide her with some fire, and when a brazier was fetched, she fed into its flames the tapas she had been wearing. When they were consumed, she announced grandly, "Now I shall dress as the new women do." "Who will make your dress?" Abner asked. Imperiously, Malama pointed to Jerusha and Amanda and said, "You and you." "Tell her you'd be happy to," Abner hastily whispered. And the two missionary women bowed and said, "We will make your dress, Malama, but we have not so much cloth because you are a very big woman." "Don't make her angry," Abner warned. But Malama's quick intelligence had caught the burden of Jerusha's meaning, and she laughed. "In all your little dresses," she cried, indicating the mission women with the sweep of her mighty arm, "there is not enough cloth for my dress." And she signaled her servants to fetch bundles from the canoe. And before the startled eyes of the mission women, length after length of the choicest Chinese fabric was unrolled. Settling finally on a brilliant red and a handsome blue, she pointed to the house dress worn by Amanda Whipple and announced quietly, "When I return to shore, I shall be dressed like that." Having given the command, she went to sleep, her naked bulk protected from flies by servants who swept her constantly with feathered wands. When she woke, Captain Janders inquired if she would like some ship's food. But she refused haughtily and ordered her servants to lift great calabashes of food from the canoe, so that while the mission wives perspired over the tent-like dress they were building, she reclined and feasted on gigantic portions of roast pig, breadfruit, baked dog, fish, and 3 quarts of purple poi. Midway in the meal, her attendants hammered her stomach in ancient massage rituals so that she could consume more, and during these interruptions she grunted happily as the food was manipulated into more comfortable positions inside her cavernous belly. Keoki explained proudly, "The Ali'inui has to eat huge meals 5 or 6 times a day so that the common people will see from a distance that she is a great woman." Into the evening, the missionary women sewed, while their husbands prayed that Malama would receive them well and allow them to lodge a mission at Lahaina. But the seamen of the Thetis prayed no less devoutly that soon both the missionaries and the fat woman would leave, so that the girls, waiting anxiously on shore, could swim out to the brig and take up their accustomed work.